Welcome to the Vine and River podcast. Here, authorities in the world of wine help us understand the intersection of vine and water. This podcast is authored by Russian Riverkeeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River, one of the largest water resources in Sonoma County, California. I am your host, Lenka Davis. Welcome to the first episode of Vine and River Podcast. First, I would like to explain why we are connecting the topics of water and viticulture. Our home, California, lies in a drought-prone climate, and grape growing and agriculture in general not only depends on water resources, it also determines how many of those resources are left over for other types of use. In this episode, we will be focusing on why and how water is needed in the vine growing, how to make most of the water we have, and how to protect its integrity. We'll be talking with Garrett Buckland, the partner at Premier Viticulture. I will only cherry-pick some of the Garrett's largest accomplishments to mention that Garrett is a longtime board member of Napa Valley Vine Growers. He is a founding member of the Napa Valley Farm Worker Foundation. He served on the Groundwater Sustainability Plan Advisory Committee and worked on the Napa River Historical Ecology Project. Garrett has also converted thousands of acres of vineyards from conventional to organic farming. And in 2023, much deservedly, he received the Napa Valley Grower of the Year Award. To frame our conversation, let's start with some statistics. So on the positive side, according to California Water Watch, California reservoirs are now filled to 19% above historic averages. However, on the cautionary side, California Water Watch also shows that about 29% of the monitored wells in California are still below normal levels, and these represent about 60% of our water sourcing in the drought years. So this means that a couple of relieving winters did not really solve all of our problems. To bring this to the wine industry, from the reading of the Silicon Valley Bank State of the Wine Industry reports, water availability remains one of the five largest negative contributors to winery sentiment index, and that's true in 2021, 2022, and 2023, the others being the economy, labor, wine substitutes, and capital. So let's delve into the toolkit for a sustainable wine grower, and I'd like to systematically start from vineyard establishment and soil preparation. So if I'm the vineyard manager and I want to make sure that I am using the water resources wisely, what do I need to do with the soil?
There's a lot of different soils that are more conducive to dry farming, for example, or minimal supplemental irrigation. We're lucky here, at least in the North Coast, that there's kind of an even spread. You know, we've got these big alluvial plains for all of our valleys where you find most of our grapes, and they have quite a bit of water holding capacity. So the number one thing that you need to start with is always know what's in the soil. So we dig soil pits, we actually go through and we evaluate where is the water, is there, you know, we're doing this in the summertime, oftentimes there's residual water just 4 or 5 feet down. And so that exploratory kind of thing with our soil pits is really the first step. And then thinking about kind of the style of farming and how I would get through the rest of the season, not just this year, next year, establishment years, but 30, 40, 50 years. We're looking to build a vineyard that really is future-proof. We know that as our climate changes, sometimes these resources won't be there. They may be there and there's a regulatory reason why we can't use them. And so building in flexibility is something that is kind of the most important thing. And that starts from the soil up. So we tend to do a very prescriptive ground preparation that really allows deeper roots for all of our vines. And then we're looking to get an understanding and really match the rootstock that we would use. You know, grapevines, we all think about the varieties that we taste. We have Cabernet Sauvignon, we have Chardonnay, we have these varieties that are part of the above ground plant. But the most important thing in a vineyard is what its rootstock is. And then we don't talk about that much, but we have 30 or so different rootstocks. Every last one of them has a different, either drought tolerance built in or some sort of nematode resistance, things that have characteristics that we as viticulturists like to maximize that trait or aspect and put it in the right place for the right reason. So where water is the biggest concern, I'm instantly thinking about a drought-tolerant rootstock. We have five or six really good ones off the shelf that you can put into a system like that. And
can you be specific about which ones you would use?
Quite a few. 110R is a very important one. So rootstocks are bred from different native varieties in the United States. You might find Vitis riparia growing in a stream. We often think of those as kind of like native grapevines. If you were driving around the country and you just saw a really big grapevine growing 50 feet up in the trees, it's most likely something like riparia or Vitis californica. We have things like Rupestris and Berlandieri. You can go to the desert plains of Arizona and Texas and these really hot environments. And they have really great drought tolerance built in. That's where they grew up for eons. And somebody who was really smart a long time ago said, let's breed these together and get the traits that we're looking for. So just like fruit trees would do the same thing, you can get a rootstock for a fruit tree that'll make it a 20-foot tall tree or a 5-foot tall tree. We can use that same sort of thing in a grapevine to control its water use. If you have a property with a limited resource or one that you're building to be kind of future-proof, we tend to group things starting with the Rupestris rootstocks. It's a good start. So 110R, 140 Ruggieri, these are bulletproof type rootstocks that really in their genetics allow them to handle high stress levels and warmer soils. So that allows me to, if I have the resource, to put out what I need. If I don't have the resource, I'm not having to water something every single week just to keep it alive. There's been a major shift in the industry to really, again, think about the future-proofing component. But I look at vineyards we used to put in 30 years ago, and the goal was to make them as small as possible and manipulate every last bit of them and water them twice a week and have total control. Today,
Henry Paria is very, very useful for
it's
that.
Perfect one. Yeah, it's a great example. So a vineyard that you don't, that you just put that in and you do kind of shallow groundwork and you don't really put a lot back into the system, you get a vineyard that requires ongoing maintenance for the rest of its life. So we're in the process of ripping a lot of those out and replanting them to a much more sustainable, built-in sustainability into the system.
I love how you started below the ground. So imagine there's a viticulturalist listening to us that is maybe on these alluvial plains that we have here in the valley. And imagine there's someone listening from Santa Barbara County, from some of the sandy outcrops that has high drainage. How would you think about these two situations differently?
Yeah, it's interesting that we don't get to deal with a lot of sandy soils here in the North Coast, but in other places in the world, we have, sandy soils usually mean that roots can go pretty deep. And so a lot of times in those cases, the roots are just following the native soil moisture. And you can get by with, I know it's something we don't do a lot anymore, but the old style used to be you would just flood irrigate a vineyard like that once during the year and then you're done with it. So there's value in that. We can recreate those types of things with drip irrigation. So you're doing kind of a big drink, but you're doing them just a couple times a year. So in overall water use, our water use can be reduced. We're just watering a little bit bigger volume and a little bit bigger area. But understanding the water holding capacity, sort of inches of water per foot, is really the number one thing that you need to get. And then of course, how you rip it and how you can prep the ground. We need to be really respectful of other issues. Erosion is a big issue. Sometimes I'd love to have roots that go as deep as possible, but in order to get that, I have to do some pretty extreme things in the ground prep that can create some other problems. So It might increase the erosion risk. And here in Napa, we have a lot of rainfall in the wintertime. We can get 40 to some of these mountain sites, 80 inches of rain, and it comes in a very short amount of time. And so keeping soil on property is our number one goal. It has been since we put in the Hillside Ordinance back in 1991. So now we have erosion control plans for vineyards. Sonoma County does as well. There's good trends for making sure that doing the right thing in one place doesn't create another problem in another.
Somewhere else.
Yeah.
I imagine that you do some ripping, but then you use cover crops to stabilize the soil, or is it something else?
Yeah. So the number one way to keep soil on property is to have some sort of permanent cover. Grapevines are a permanent cover, but they don't cover the whole ground. So we tend to fill in the missing spaces with mostly California natives in hillside vineyards, which is really exciting. We use a lot of fescues, which are kind of low-growing grasses. We don't water them, basically. So once they use the water that's available to them, they just sort of go dormant. But they're keeping a nice cap over the soil, and we don't have to really disturb the soil once we get those established. What's amazing is we're able to actually go back and put California native grasses into a managed system. As you look around the hills, they're all really dry right now. Almost every grass you're looking at is an invasive species. So wild oats, all these things that today create massive fire risk and become a problem for us. We're looking in every situation to kind of minimize those trade-offs. And of course, a permanent cover crop is not the best answer for everything. It does use water, and it is a challenge, and I have to manage that trade-off. Where I want a permanent cover crop, it does increase the baseline water use for that whole site.
I think you opened a very important point of view, is that the cover crops consume a lot of water. I've seen a lot of people that are starting dry farming, eliminate everything, all the competition but the vines in the vineyard. But on the other hand, how much of the cover crop can be used as a mulch that prevents evaporation, or something that helps penetration of water or prevents the water runoff? How much water do the cover crops contribute versus take away in the season?
It's a trade-off, and a permanent cover crop can really increase the amount of what we call evapotranspiration from a property. What's happening is that it burns through water that's in the top 2 feet, where most of those roots are. It burns through them really fast. So if our last rain is in May, sometimes I'm using a lot of that water over the next month, month and a half. If that first 2 feet was available for grapevine roots, then that water's already gone. And so that's where, really good ground prep, getting my roots deeper, having them sort of draw from a totally different area of the soil is a goal. It doesn't have to be a permanent cover crop. Every property can benefit from a wintertime cover crop. Even if we're in a tilled system, there's ways to make that a improvement over whatever the baseline was, where you go around the world and you see people's kind of bad agricultural practices. Almost all of them are having like tillage that sits through the winter and not having like life on the property. And so if you are tilling, it's just very important to make sure that we get a high biomass cover crop back in. You're doing it, thinking about ways to do it like every other row, kind of lessening the impact should always be a goal. And what's amazing now is that that's become kind of standard practice for the average grape grower. The old days, it was create a dust mulch. I could dry farm, but I have to get rid of all the grass. And that works, but it's not always solving the rest of the trade-offs we talked about. I have a hard time sequestering carbon in those grounds. I may be
contributing. You're denaturing your biomass.
Exactly. Yeah. We're managing for kind of an extreme in water savings, but in the other area, I might be creating another problem. So, a smart grower and a sustainable grower sort of looks at all those and chooses the best path that works for them. And we don't want to demonize disking necessarily, but if we're going to do it, we want to make sure it has a really good value and it's for a reason.
So this is very interesting that you're essentially saying that there's a toolkit for people that choose to till their soil to still maintain some moisture in their soil.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can grow the highest biomass cover crop on the planet here because we have ample wintertime rain and it's warm. In any situation, we want to make sure that we all winter long we don't have bare soil. That's a bad thing for everybody. It's not helping us with our climate goals and it's not helping us with erosion. And it's just bad land management. I go back to France every year, and we always visit different wine regions. And it's amazing if you look at places that have been farmed forever, you'll look at like a vineyard or an orchard or something, and it's super rocky. Well, all the trees over here, like same soil, it's not very rocky.
Yeah.
You go and you dig a backhoe pit there, and it's like, well, there's rock here, but what looks like 100% rock on this vineyard property is like 50% rock in the forest. And really, the reason it's so rocky is that they lost all their soil. It's runoff over the last 100 years.
How do you lose your soil when you till?
Biggest thing is wintertime rains, at least in our climate. We'll get really big rains that soils are saturated and we get surface runoff, basically.
Where does that runoff go to? Is this a potential problem for our river sheds?
Yeah, it really can be. So I mentioned erosion control plans before. We build a lot of things in a new vineyard or a vineyard that gets replanted that requires an erosion control plan. We build sediment retention basins. We build permanent features in the vineyard like grass strips and all these things that really work to keep every little bit of soil from leaving the property. And what's remarkable is you can actually build to these engineering steps and completely clean up a legacy problem. And so we oftentimes really encourage people to redevelop their vineyard. You'd think it'd be like, don't redevelop your vineyard. You're gonna,
you just know, work with what you have.
There's a lot of concern. There's a lot of risk. Maybe you get landslides, things like that. But a legacy problem is one that should be dealt with. And going back and modernizing an old vineyard that might have been planted in the 70s or 80s on a hillside allows us to put in erosion control measures that essentially make erosion irrelevant. And I think we should all, you know, look at that as a success and really send that to the rest of the viticultural world. Like, this is what we should be doing. If you think about the Dust Bowl, you think about all the things that happened in the past, and it's like, you know, we forget history, right? Like, soil's important. Keep it around.
We have been talking about things that are lower from the graft union, so let me go up from the graft union and talk about the importance of scion. You've mentioned rootstocks, but does a selection of your scion play any role in water efficiency?
Yeah, it really can. You know, the scion we're talking about is the variety that you might find on a wine label. So if you're growing Cabernet Sauvignon, if you're growing Cabernet Franc, those are really closely related. Cabernet Sauvignon is more drought tolerant than Cabernet Franc is in general. They're both Vitis vinifera, they're both the same species and genus. They're just different, in a way they're kind of like different races. So they have different phenotypes, essentially. Same genotype, different phenotype. Some of that phenotype is drought tolerance a little bit. We have some of the classics. Syrah can behave totally differently than Cabernet Sauvignon in its water relations. Most of what we're doing here, at least in the North Coast, is pretty much in the same standard deviation. You know, we don't have major outliers, but it is something that can play a small role. Not as big as rootstock, but it is a small role. One of the bigger ones is just how do we train that vine? What kind of trellis system do we have? What kind of what size do we make this vine? How do we actually do some of our cultural operations to make it so that it's not a really water hungry crop? Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop you there and go back to Cabernet and Syrah, because I think those are very good poster children for isohydric and anisohydric varieties.
Right.
Could you describe what happens to the vine, how it manages its water supply, Cabernet Sauvignon versus Syrah, and why, for example, someone that's considering the variety that is going to withstand the drought, why this could be a better choice than, say, a Syrah?
It's interesting, you know, so plants are really amazing machines. We basically, we take CO2 and we turn it into other stuff. It's really kind of cool. And stomatal control, some of these are genetic traits that are built in to the vine, and then others are kind of cultural traits. So we can stress a vine and actually train a vine to be more comfortable with less water use. Now, Syrah is a really interesting case. Like Syrah, the fruit will shrivel up, we'll get hybrids, and we'll get all sorts of different characteristics. Some of them are water related, some of them are just phenotype things that we talked about. How a vineyard responds to high stress is a really interesting thing. So if we get these very high stress points, you'll get yellowing of leaves, you'll get leaves that fall off, you'll get some varieties abort their fruit before they get rid of their leaves. And you know, you can kind of rank some of those varieties in drought tolerance in a lot of different ways. Some of that's not an absolute. Take, for example, Bordeaux just opened up adding new drought tolerant, using air quotes, drought tolerant varieties. Keep in mind, like, rootstock's the most important for drought tolerance. But they added a handful of things that on paper look great.
Like Touriga Nacional and Arin Arnoa.
So, like Arin Arnoa, I've got a vineyard here in Napa with some Arin Arnoa, and it's been there for a long time.
Is it delicious? Does it make good wine?
No, it's not working for us. But it's in a cooler area. It's in Coombsville area, and I've got Petit Verdot and Cabernet Sauvignon right next to it. And every year our inner NOAA burns. It just melts. It's like it's the least heat tolerant variety that I have in the entire existing vineyard. We always have these kind of grasses greener on the other side thing, and we're learning like everyone has with viticulture for thousands of years, like what is working for our situation.
You have mentioned that you can change the tolerance to drought based on how you treat the canopy. So what do you do to increase the water use efficiency?
Yeah, so grapes, important to go back to what are the most drought tolerant crops that we have. Like grapes are up there in the top 10%. Mm. And so other things that we can do to make sort of in season the same vineyard more drought tolerant are very easy, and they come to like our cultural practices that focus around mostly handwork and how we have light intercept the canopy. So one of the big ones is in a drought year we try to get a big canopy. Big canopy grows deeper roots, and then we really try to get rid of the young leaves. And so as a grapevine grows, it doesn't just magically have all its canopy. It takes, you know, a month or so to get a full shoot growing, but they grow laterals as well. They grow these small leaves that can't regulate their stomata very well. And so if you just remove those from the plant, we can keep older, more mature leaves that are able to handle higher stress around, and we can get rid of the small leaves that are using water inefficiently, just get them out of there. And so,
got it, but in the sunny climate, how worried should you be that you're going to have sunburn when you do that?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. Oh. So therein lies the problem. If we take off too much of that canopy, we overexpose our fruit, and we get years like 2022 where we had record temperatures and everybody loses their crop. And, you know, we can't be a sustainable business if you lose your crop. So we got to make sure that we're mitigating for that. I've found the best way to mitigate for that is row orientation. So as we go back and change our row orientation, if I can line up my vineyard so that during the hottest part of the day, the top of the canopy is shading all the other leaves on the vineyard, I can cut down on water use tremendously.
And that's about 20 to 30 degrees east of north or
yeah,
some
so,
such?
Yeah, so it's a diagonal off mm-hmm. of true north. And, you know, we land anywhere between 30 and 40 degrees, depending on, at least at our latitude.
Mm-hmm.
This changes
mm-hmm.
when you get to Washington or British Columbia or somewhere else. But at least for, you know, the North Coast latitude, that's having that's what we call a softer row orientation allows the upper parts of the canopy to take a beating while cooling the fruit and protecting all the leaves below it. So I can run higher stress levels safely. I can forego a irrigation when I would otherwise want to irrigate in a different row orientation. And I can also put in a cross arm or some of these trellis things that change the architecture of what leaves are intercepting light. And so,
but when you are building a cross arm or are you doing a T trellis, aren't you actually consuming more water?
You can, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's, again, going back to the trade-offs, if I can make a cross arm, I can shade my fruit for longer.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm really interested in is not what the leaves look like at the end of the year. I'm interested in what the fruit looks like at the end of the year. So I might create a system that carries more stress longer, but in the end, I'm allowing a more shaded canopy over my fruit, and so I don't have to water to keep that alive. And as we design a vineyard for the future, the most important is if we can get a row orientation change and get on a drought tolerant rootstock. If we can do that, then it kind of doesn't matter what I do for my trellis. I can increase the background water use, but I can also run higher stress levels. But I can create systems that I don't have to have supplemental irrigation. It's interesting. I look at how we developed vineyards in the past, and you'd say, well, which is the longest row? If I orient my vineyard this way, I'll just have it go along the driveway because I won't have
yeah the tractor turnaround.
Yeah, I don't have to turn my tractor a bunch of times, and it's like, well, okay, that's good, but what happens when you lose your crop one out of what used to be 1 out of 10 years? And more frequently we're seeing that risk of high temperature at Labor Day and all that being more like a 1 out of 5 or a 3 out of 5 when we're in the last couple years. From just a mitigating risk, it's crazy that you wouldn't think about, you know, what's the softest row orientation. when you explain it to somebody, as I'm redeveloping their vineyard, it's like, oh, that's a no-brainer. It allows us not to have to do other mitigation, like shade cloth or excessively water. You know, the interesting thing is that with high temperature, more water doesn't really get me out of trouble. It's when the fruit is too hot, the fruit just melts and raisins up, and we lose a crop. So it's important to kind of divorce those two things. I can't necessarily keep my grapes fully hydrated by just adding more water, but I can keep my canopy on and I can keep it shading the fruit.
When it comes to irrigation, I have heard you talk about property where you are running two irrigation lines and one of them provides misting. Does this help with the ambient atmosphere and how?
Yeah, that's a good one. So it's very standard today. As we build a vineyard, we put in usually two drip lines. So we have what we call a primary drip line, which would water every single vine. That allows me to, if I want to put out one watering during the year at Verazin, I can water everything. If I then put in a secondary line, where we call it a double poly, that secondary line, I can put an emitter just on replants. If I have a gopher that kills a plant, or I have a weak area, I can just water a small percentage of my vineyard. And that's kind of normal. Most of my vineyards today were doing, you know, I might water every week, but just the replants, and it might be 1% of the vineyard. And so in the old days, if I didn't have the resources to put in two of those lines, then I would water everything, and then I'd have a way too vigorous vineyard, I'd use way too much water. And so that's kind of a normal thing that wasn't really a thing in the 80s. Now, in all these vineyards, I'm putting in a third line, which is basically a line that we can use for micro sprinklers or misters. When I do that, I can go to some of these really, what we call high vapor pressure deficit. That's a complicated one. I don't expect everyone to understand that. But basically, it's when it's hot and dry. Not just hot, but when we get north winds here in our area, we usually get three straight days of very low humidity and temperatures over 100. That's really the problem. It's not the high temperature, it's the low humidity. And so in a normal vineyard, you might say, well, I see this heat event coming, let me just put water out everywhere. And then the vine's like, great, I can handle this. They burn through all that water, but I might have to put out like 8 gallons of vine, and I have to do it well ahead of the event. And sometimes it's at a time where I don't really want to do it. I might be close to harvest, I might compromise wine quality, canopy might still be growing. There's a lot of reasons why flexibility to do something else would be important. So that's where we came up with my first system we put in was in probably 2006. When I was a kid, we used to, in these very, very high events, used to turn on overhead sprinklers for frost, but that's a lot of water, you know, and that's something that we really don't want to be doing. So these misters use way less than the drip system, and we can turn them on for 1 or 2 hours during the day, and I can have all 3 days way protected and use way less than I would with one watering.
How much does one of those misters emit in a day's worth of misting?
Everything we're using in the vineyard today is probably about 20 to 30% at the high level, less than the drip system would. So if I need to protect for 3 hours, then it's already way less than me irrigating for 3 hours. They go all the way down to probably about 10% of the water that a drip system would use in a very fine mist. Some properties we have to do filtration of our water that's pretty extreme to get to those, you know, true misters. And in a lot of cases we're doing a very low flow micro sprinkler. And when I turn it on, what it does is it changes the humidity in the vineyard. So all of a sudden the vapor pressure deficit goes down. It's never enough water to even wet the ground. You can stand out there and it's like, whew, now it's like Florida out here, humid
yes.
and hot. But what it means is that the vine doesn't have to struggle for water to cool the leaf surface.
What would be the ambient temperature change?
Well, let's take the 2022 heat event. We saw 119 degrees.
Oh my God, yes.
In places.
Yes.
And, you know, I backing up a little bit, I have a weather station, multiple in every single vineyard. We're understanding the climate in our vineyards more today than we ever have. And so I'm always using those tools to help guide these decisions. So I get a nice alert on my phone that says we've hit a mark, and I can call the irrigator, or I can turn the misters on from my phone sometimes.
That's amazing.
It's a neat trick.
Yeah.
But you know, we can use this modern technology to really help us what would otherwise be a default watering, skip the watering entirely.
When I talked about this mister system of yours, which I greatly admire you for using that, it's a brilliant idea. With other viticulturalists, one of the buts that I get is, but there has to be a certain price for the fruit to warrant the cost of installing that third line. Whom is this feasible for? Do these people have to be in Napa Valley, or can they be also, I don't know, West Sonoma Coast,
yeah,
or less premium areas?
I do need to be a little more humble on this one. We get lucky here in Napa. We do command a very high price. We have high margins. These are systems that we can build into. The land around here is minimum of $500,000 an acre. It's not for everybody. But the nice thing about putting a system in like this is that if you think about it ahead of time while you're developing a vineyard, we can keep these costs under $2,500, $3,000 an acre. You can really design something that would work for you, that if there's a 1 in 10 chance that it saves my crop,
then it's already
paid
for itself.
It's already paid for. If there's a 1 in 5 chance, then it's paid for even more. If it's a 3 in 5, why wouldn't you be doing this? And that's just something where a lot of people probably aren't used to it yet. And, you know, I'm hoping that they can at least think about these things as they build in the underwriting for replanting their vineyard in 5 years, 10 years. We should be building more flexibility. And it's not you don't have to use it. It can just sit there and you use it once every 3 years, something like that.
What happens when you don't, do they get clogged? Do they have to be maintained?
We've landed on a handful of providers that have really great technology, where the number one issue is we get spiders. So there's a lot of insects
yes.
in a vineyard. We love most of them. Some of them are problems, but things like spiders are great predators. We encourage them. There's these tiny little yellow spiders that if they find any small hole, they'll crawl into and just hang out there. And so some of the first iterations of misters we used, we'd find that those guys would clog them up. And even if they weren't in there, they'd leave behind a web and we wouldn't get the flow that we're looking for. And so we don't use those anymore. And nowadays we're doing these nice little heads that kind of close on themselves, and there's no access to insects there. So those are just changes that we found a product that worked, and all of a sudden that's what we run with. There's a definite learning curve to how to use them, when to use them, and what the outcome is. And we're still learning. We're learning where the boundary should be, where it's safe to even forego a misting, or where does it improve my wine quality where I'm not even at risk of some sort of damage to the fruit.
And what are some other ideas that you can use in your irrigation strategy that could be helpful?
Well, you know, the biggest one in my consulting career, I've evolved a lot on how I give recommendations. You know, we're always, in a lot of cases, we're trying to play the safest way. But to make a 100-point wine, that's $400 a bottle. We got to ride the edge quite a bit. And so when I get to like a new project, the first thing I say is, let's find a row or two rows or three rows and just go turn the irrigation off. Just cut it. Like, see what happens.
See what happens.
Yeah, because most people haven't done that. Most people haven't seen it. They've just sort of been scared about the outcome, but they haven't actually sort of found the boundary. They haven't found the bookend of what's safe and what's not. And so in most vineyards, it turns out it's like, wow, I could have just not watered.
Nothing happens.
I could have not watered for a lot longer. And so it's a mind shift that some people have to be kind of walked to a little bit, or shown that it's safe. There's ways just to understand your vineyard more that way. I mean, I've even said, I don't think we can do this. And then you go and you look at that area and you say, oh, well, maybe we can. And if I can save one water or two water or three waters or the whole season, I've learned something about the flexibility of that vineyard. And it now becomes one more tool for me to use it responsibly. Other ways during the drought, I mean, we do have properties that just don't have the resource. We don't have a well, we don't have access to water. And it's hard to make these big changes where you go from a really wet season to a really dry one. most of those are nuanced things. We can use foliar fertilizers to limp us along a little bit. We can again manage the size of our canopy, manage our outcome a little bit better, or just be fine with a little bit of earlier harvest or a little bit less crop. There's a lot of ways to get something that is a good outcome, but isn't maybe the same as a wet year or something like that. And so I think there's a understanding component as people try it and test the boundaries. They're starting to become more comfortable with all things in their vineyard.
So if someone is listening to this and thinking about the idea of removing, say, three rows from the watering, should they just do it for one watering, or should they just do it for as many waterings as they think the vines can survive?
Yeah, I like to turn it off for the whole year and see what happens.
Whole year, okay.
Obviously, the vine doesn't die overnight. You start to see the effects of stress, and one week it looks a little bit worse, and then the next week it looks worse. And so there's an opportunity to turn it back on anytime you want. But it helps that bookend. One client in particular, we have a goal of dry farming everything, and they were able to have 80% of their property looked amazing in 21 and 22, the driest years that we've had, the worst of the drought years. Those vineyards look great because we had gone through all the pain in wet years by just withholding everything from them. And so, we have what we can train in season for that year, but we also have training them over multiple years.
Right. So that goes back into your thought about the vines as the machines. So you're saying that they biologically can adapt to the lack of the water, that it's not a static system where you just turn it off and see if they survive, but that there's a mechanism in the vine as well, which is going to adapt to the new reality.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, it may not happen in season, but it can happen over a short time frame. As we understand vineyards better, we're always working on our timeline. It's a Monday. Go do Monday things. It's, every week. We think about things weekly. The vine life cycle doesn't even know what a week is. In my irrigation strategies, we're oftentimes doing bigger drinks way less frequently. And so even in a vineyard that has plenty of resource, I might water 3-4 times, but I'm watering to get a specific wine outcome. I'm looking for more acid, I'm looking for faster color, I'm looking for things that make the rest of the system more sustainable, and in the end, cutting down on the overall water use like 75% in some cases by just switching the style of how I water.
That's phenomenal. And what is another consequence of just doing the bigger drinks less often? Does that have anything to do with evaporation that happens with more frequent waterings, I assume?
Yeah, you think about the way that roots grow, they're receiving signals from the soil all the time. If they're in dry areas, changes in plant hormones happen. You end up stopping growing, you put roots in different areas. Vines are pretty smart. They're getting environmental cues quite a bit. Every plant is. And so when we sort of skip this frequency component and go to a longer duration between irrigations, we can actually make changes to where roots are budding. We don't have them run under the emitter. We can have that water go down 4 and 5 feet. There's less evaporation when that happens. There's a bigger reservoir. The soil is cooler. That's one thing that part of our irrigation is not about the water availability to the plant. Some rootstocks don't do very well in high temperature soils. And so when you water a big amount, you can actually reduce the bulk temperature of a soil. That's a longer lasting thing than how much water is even available. Keeping the humidity high is almost as important as how much free water is available to a vine as well. And those are things that, because it happens underground, we don't think about them very much. I am a big proponent to, every time you have a backhoe, go dig a vine and go look. Like, Why would we spend all of our time thinking about the above ground stuff and never really look at what are the roots doing? And you start shifting to, well, let's get a snapshot of what's happening underground, and you learn about where I should be watering and how I should be watering even better. And it gets you away from these sort of default water once a week and make sure the leaves don't fall off. If there's one take home, it's just try it. Like, what's the harm? Maybe don't try it on your whole vineyard. Try a trial section first and see if you can do it. But if you can create a more buffered system over a period of 1 or 2 or 5 years, or advance your knowledge base so that the next time you plant, you can make one that that flexibility is built in, I think everybody should be doing that.
We have started with the soils, and I would like to just create a complete loop and go back to the soils and the water. I'd like to get your thoughts on how the organic matter in the soil is going to change the water holding capacity, and how, as a grower, you can work with the organic matter, change the organic matter in your soil.
This is a really important one that I think more people are looking at, more through the lens of climate change than anything else. We have a really great opportunity with managed lands to become a permanent reservoir for storage of carbon. And I think that's something that there's co-benefits to. You know, we get additional water holding capacity out of that. We get our own confidence about a living system that, you know, again, will be more buffered. It's really hard in our climate to keep more than 2 to 3% organic matter around in a soil. And so it's a hard system just where we are in the North Coast to actually store carbon in the soil. So we think of a vineyard as a really unique way to overcome that sort of like 2 to 3% baseline that we can store. If I get an opportunity to prep a vineyard, I have access to 5 feet of soil. I can put whatever I want down there, and I can make sure that it never evolves. I can store it in there. I can now get roots through an area. Let's say I have a vineyard that's here on the valley floor, has a clay pan where nothing can get through. If I can rip that vineyard and I can get grass roots access to 2 or 3 more feet of soil, I've now doubled the amount of actual biomass that's in there. Not all of it's carbon, but I've been able to get a lot of biomass to a more access in a soil. And so managed lands are really the way to do that, and they're the best way to jumpstart a system that otherwise is kind of has this baked in, like, you know, soils want respiration. We have plenty of water here, and we have plenty of microbial activity, and it's hard for us to keep that in. One of the biggest ways is to think about how we use some of our other nutrition components. So, you know, you don't have to limit nitrogen in your vineyard, but one of the ways to sequester more carbon and not have it just being eaten up by microbes and evolved as CO2 is to use products judiciously, like nitrogen, and do a little bit less soil applied stuff, change some of the types of nitrogen we put out. It's harder in organic. You know, we have harder sources of materials. We have things that we have to source that have their own environmental impacts. And so thinking about that fertility component, it's a much bigger system here. But number one way, manage my cover crop. Number two way, be able to use waste products in a vineyard like compost. I will get up on a high horse here and wave my fist at people. The way that we use compost should be as a recycling kind of approach. The minute that we go and buy compost that somebody's making for compost,
right, the carbon footprint associated with the
trucking. Yeah, we have destroyed the entire sustainability of that industry. And so if you have to go out and source materials to make your compost, it's probably good for you to look back at how sustainable is that. Using yard waste as compost, using byproducts from other actual industries where it would otherwise be a waste product, that's the way to make it more sustainable. And so, you know, using judicious use of compost, how I water, how deep my roots get, what kind of cover crop I use, those are all things that allow me to permanently store carbon in a soil. And then, of course, the one thing we don't talk about is the crop. If I can get a bigger crop, I've just taken a lot more CO2 out of the air. That's temporary, right? Because we make it into wine, but that wine has a 3-year lifespan, and then it's got, for some people, a 15-year lifespan in their cellar. Those are all things that make it so that, at least on at a baseline level, our industry is a good candidate for helping with sequestering carbon.
That's one way to look at it.
Yeah. And of course, we need to be doing the right things to maximize that. Obviously, on the vineyard end, like all growing things, we get the benefit of carrying the lift there. Should we make lighter bottles? Absolutely. Should we limit, you know, the transportation component? Is it better to put a case of glass on a train than it is on an airplane? Absolutely. All those things are things that people are thinking about and integrating into their business left and right. But in terms of the vineyard itself, we are the more buffered we can make it, and the less requirements for these ongoing regular adding stuff to it and getting stuck in the cycle of having to intervene all the time, makes for a much more sustainable system, and it helps everything.
Thank you so much, Garrett. I think we could spend the rest of the evening just on these topics, as they're incredibly important, but also the amount of insight that you show and that you share with everyone is really impressive. I am really grateful for all your time that you've dedicated to talking to us about this, and I am really looking forward to talking to you at some point in the future, maybe on some other water subjects.
Oh, this is great, and I appreciate the opportunity to grandstand a little bit here. This has been great, and you know, I think just to wrap it up, we're in a good place here in 2024 to really make the gains that we've had in sustainability become permanent in how we design vineyards, how we move forward with this, and the best years are in front of us right now.
That's fantastic to hear. And with that, we are going to finish this episode.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider donating to Russian River Keeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River. Go to RussianRiverKeeper.org to learn more or to contribute today.